Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio.
To this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week, we bring you the best news, views, and interviews with the leaders, clinicians, founders, journalists, politicians that are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am a CEO and founder of a health tech business myself called PocDoc, and our Healthy Heart Check delivers the equivalent of the NHS Health Check in just 9 minutes. You can get it on any high street across the country. And if you're lucky enough to live in an area where we're deployed through the NHS, you may be able to access it through the NHS. So have a look for the Healthy Heart Check either on our website, which is pocdoc.co, or go to Boots, Superdrug, Well, Asda, a number of others, and you can find it there. Thank you very much to PocDoc for supporting the show. It's great to have that support. Thank you also if you're listening live on UK Health Radio, the fabulous UK Health Radio. We really appreciate the live platform. There are so many great presenters on the station doing great shows, so please do take the time to check them out. Thank you if you are listening to this on demand on any of the podcast channels, obviously Spotify, Apple, Google, Acast, etc., Amazon, on all of them. We get downloads now in over 50 countries every single month, so thank you so much for listening from Saudi Arabia through to Peru, through to Vietnam. We really, really, really love having you here. Thank you so much. And then finally, if you're watching this on YouTube, hello, I'm waving. And then if you are or on my Instagram channel, which is at Steve Roost, where we take the best clips and we put them out in a sort of Instagrammable, easily scrollable format, then hello and welcome. So that's the admin out the way. On to today's show. So, before I do today's show, last week's show was with David McLaughlin, Curb Health. If you have an interest in how technology is being used to curb addiction, particularly alcohol addiction or alcohol misuse, it's a super interesting show. David's one of the leading clinicians at the Priory Clinic and has set up his own health tech business called Curb, C-U-R-B. Both for people that need to stop or should stop drinking alcohol, as well as for people that want to just reduce their intake. Really interesting show. It made me reevaluate things around alcohol. So I can completely recommend that show. But now on to today's show. I say this every show, to be fair, but I am super excited about today's guest because Giles, I've recently got to know Giles, I'd say, over the last 6 months, and he's rapidly elevated himself into one of my favorite people to encounter at events and to speak to. And I'm super excited that we get to share what he's doing in his company, which is called Pinpoint Data Science. And it's developed the Pinpoint test, which is an AI-driven cancer diagnostic test. Obviously, he's going to be able to explain it much better than I will, clearly. But PocDoc and Pinpoint are both on the same NHS innovation program. And it's been fascinating to learn about what Giles is up to. And interestingly enough, fun fact about Giles, he actually used to be a pop star in China prior to him building the AI cancer diagnostic business of the future. So Giles, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm excellent, actually. And I would say I'm also really pleased to be on your show. And you are indeed also one of my favorite people to encounter at events. I think we have good chats
about
the state of health tech and probably some stuff that we won't say on here, but
we only have one rule: as long as you don't swear, you can say pretty much what you want.
Okay, I'm gonna have to work very hard on that because I am naturally a bit sweary.
let's not Johan gets very upset if you swear, because then he's got to edit it out in the
what happens if I swear in Chinese?
Probably fine. I don't know. Johan can tell us during one of the breaks, but probably okay. So there's quite a lot here to get into, but why don't we start, because it's the top of the show. Let's start with what Pinpoint is and why you focused on it and what the magic is and what the problem is that you solve. And obviously we are a broad church in terms of a listener group. Everyone yeah. has heard of cancer, but there's probably a lot of stuff that you identified that people are unaware of in that journey, in those pathways that actually you built Pinpoint to solve. So how did it come about? What's the problem? And, you know, why are you so passionate about it?
Well, so I will, there's lots of different times you could start this. You can start it when my chief scientist got cancer in 2004. And as a consequence of that, he was an astrophysicist using machine learning, as it was called then. Obviously, we have to call it AI now, but it's the same thing. We were into it before it was cool. and so he said, let's use that to look at the difference between cancer and not cancer, rather than the difference between nebula and galaxies, which is really fun, but it's not going to change your life. And of course, he almost died. And so therefore, he was really, you know, I think it refocuses the mind. Mm-hmm. And it certainly was the thing that motivated both of us. So I spent 10 years in China. I got back from China. I was looking for the next thing to do. And I looked at lots of different stuff. I wanted to do something to make the world a better place. So I looked at clean tech. I looked at health tech. I looked at hemp tech. I looked at quite a lot of different things in that kind of like, how do we improve the human condition space?
But you weren't by background a clinician, though.
No. I'm broadly, I'm a sort of potted entrepreneur. I've done lots of different things. I've been in the music business. I've been in the media business. I had a big advertising company in Beijing that was doing, you know, big adverts for brands like Levi's and Nike and stuff. And that was after I was a pop star, but that's a longer story for it later on, possibly. But, you know, so I've done a lot of different things. And actually, one of the things I say that is completely true is that learning an alien culture and a completely different language and way of doing business, and indeed dealing with the complex bureaucracy of the Chinese state, is quite a good preparation for dealing with the NHS.
That's a great line. So did you rock up in China without any idea about what you were going to do?
Yeah, well, so plan? Yeah. So this takes me back to actually it. Neatly joins up, because you should be able to neatly join up one stories, right? So I'm going to tell a story that's a little bit intense. So, you know, like it involves death. So okay. For those of the in the audience, just be prepared. Also, I think it's funny. So if you do laugh, don't feel bad. But like, you know, just be prepared.
You built it up quite a bit now. So
yeah. So my mother died when I was 16 of cancer, and I was in the corridors of the hospital in London where she died. And I'm with my father, and a nurse comes up to my father, and, you know, it's probably her first week at work, because what she does is not particularly professional, but, you know, she's probably a bit confused too. And she comes up to her and she says, "Excuse me, Mr. Tully, what would you like us to do with the body?" Right?
Wow.
Yeah. Intense.
Okay.
Right? And my father said, he turned around and, you know, incredibly British, he said, "I'm terribly sorry. I wasn't expecting my wife to die tonight. What would you suggest?"
Is that really what he said?
Yeah, that is what he said. And, you know, I there were sort of two things I realized in that moment. One, well, that's sort of brilliant. And when you tell that to Americans, they just laugh at how British it is once yeah. they've gotten over the fact that it's a bit complicated to laugh at death, but we're British. We laugh at these things. But the other thing was, oh, he doesn't know what he's doing, right? And my dad is an incredibly competent man. He's super smart. He's run businesses. He worked for IBM. He has a band. He's a hyper-competent, busy guy. And he was completely lost. And what it made me realize is the thing that we all realize at some point, which is nobody knows what they're doing. Right. Mm. Like your parents don't know what they're doing. That you, when you're a kid, you think, oh, the grown-ups must have a plan, right? Like they've got a plan. They know what they're doing. They don't. And when you realize that, if it's too early, that's a real problem, right? Like if you have to take mummy's crack pipe out of her hands when you're four, that's a really serious issue for you. You're going to be scarred for the rest of your life. And if you're 30 and, you know, you find out that actually the adults don't know what they're doing, that's probably a bit late. You've probably been a bit too coddled. But 16 is probably a reasonably good age. And it made me realize, oh, no one knows what they're doing. The thing to get good at is not knowing what you're doing, right? And so that is what led to me moving to China, was I need to put myself in the most alien situation where I understand the least, where I can therefore be forced to get good at coming up with something in a difficult circumstance, because you will always be presented in life, and particularly as an entrepreneur, but frankly, I think it's true for everybody, with situations where you've no idea what you're doing and you're going to have to come up with something. And if you've got experience in that, like, you will be better at it the next time you do it. And so I moved to China, not knowing anybody there. I had one friend who's actually now my chief communications officer, who had been to China and was going to come there. But when I went, he wasn't there. He was finishing a degree in Chinese at Durham. And so I went on my own and I got on a course to learn Chinese. And it was 2004, when people had just realized China was going to be a thing. And so that course I was on was twice oversubscribed when I arrived, and they had to put people in what is almost certainly was a brothel that was down the road from the school,
right?
And so, you know, I sort of had this like amazing indoctrination into a totally different world. I learned about 3 weeks of Chinese, and from that I went, okay, actually I hate formal study, that's not really the way that I do things, but I've got enough of a grounding that I can go out there, I'm good at languages anyway, and I'll just go and get there. And that slowly led me to being in the music industry, and then becoming a pop star, and then producing one of China's biggest indie rock bands, who are still huge. You can find them on Spotify. They're called Escape Plan. And I produced their first album.
That's amazing.
Yeah, they're very cool. I love them. They've got one song that's kind of like the Yesterday, or, you know, like some kind of like the love song of their generation. Like, people sing it on The Voice, like anywhere in the world I'll meet a Chinese person and they'll be able to sing it back to me. It's lovely, and they're really lovely guys who went from nothing to, you know, actually being stars, and I helped them do that. Well, actually I could claim it was my fault, because I basically saw them when they were on the edge and I said, I will finish your album and make it this happen, and then they blew up.
Did you have musical skills before you started to be a musical producer? Okay.
Well, yes and no. So, like, again, I had trained as a child. I could play the saxophone. You can see one in the background there.
I can see the saxophones, yeah.
So, yes, but at the same time, I had never made music on computers before. And actually, I got that job from a guy who I met in outside a restaurant, who said, you should be my musical director. And I didn't tell him I didn't know how to do that. And I got some lessons in how to do that from a friend of mine who went to Berkeley. And he said, oh, it's easy. And of course, if you've already trained in, like, you know, I had a grade 7 in clarinet, and, you know, I had like grade 6 theory, and so I knew what I was doing.
Right.
But that extra bit that says use computers was something I knew nothing about. And I was very lucky to basically have an opportunity to learn how to do that in this environment, which actually turned out to not be it. Basically, the company disappeared after a year and a half, and so I got to experience being a music director and learning how to make music without really having any consequence on my career. And that meant I could then produce other people, I'd learn all the tools, and, you know, so again, just,
do you know what I love? So we'll come back to Pinpoint and how it's revolutionizing AI diagnostics in just one second, dear listeners. But this is why I love doing this show, and why, Giles, you're one of my favorite people, because I think that in health tech in the UK, there's a real lack of, I would say, not ethnic diversity of background, but there's also a lack of that, but also almost like an experiential diversity of background. There's a massive majority of founders, senior people who start health tech businesses who have been clinicians or who have been in the system the entire time. They may not have had such a broad experience beyond that.
And of course that could be really good, and you don't want to not have those people.
No,
but, you know, at the same time, I agree, I think that one of the things that's made us survive as long as we have, and get to where we've got to, is that we're quite a sort of interesting bunch of characters who have got a varied background. You know, our chair, for example, Nigel, has done everything across all bits of the healthcare business, but he's also got an MSc in like medieval wood construction. Like,
well, I mean, who doesn't in this day and age, quite frankly?
Exactly. And so, but the point is, it gives him this sort of like complex richness as an individual that makes him much more capable of looking at things in a different way.
What on earth is medieval wood construction? What is that, like lances for jousting?
No,
Like, what
no,
is
no.
that?
So you know when you see like a barn, right, that's got no nails in the construction and all of the like corners
Oh,
and stuff have been like put together by
yeah.
careful joints, right? It's
Yeah,
that kind
okay.
of
Oh, that is
not
impressive.
yeah. And it's very
Yeah.
difficult to do, and but of course he's an absolute nightmare to go around an old barn with, because he'd be like, oh, they've ruined that scarf joint. It's a disaster.
I can only imagine. I can only imagine. You were in China. You did some incredible stuff in China. How does that transition into Pinpoint, and what does Pinpoint do? Like, or what was the initial insight around it?
Yeah, so I get back. I spend about 3 years. So my chief scientist and I, we meet because of Dungeons and Dragons, right? So that's where you meet a nerd. They're not down the pub. They are doing something quiet indoors with a pencil and paper. And so we would talk after gaming. And the thing that both motivated us both was early cancer detection has got to be a problem we can solve. It's perfect for machine learning. Let's look at ideas. And we looked at, electronic noses. Interesting things to investigate via blood, like loads of different ideas. And after about 3 years, I went, he said to me, look, I've got a group of academics and medics that have been working on this for the last 5 years. We think it's a business, but we don't know anything about business. Would you come and talk to us and see whether or not there's something in it? And so I turned up there, and actually beforehand, I've got this little video of me basically saying these people need a chief artist. They need someone to help them as scientists communicate their vision to the world in sort of more normal terms, right? Maybe normal's not the right word, but like just understandable. And so I turned up there and I sat with them for 4 hours, and they bombarded me with facts about CT scanners and early detection and, CT DNA and MRI machines and PCRs, which we all know what they are now, but at the time, it was all new. And the concept of biomarkers you can measure in blood, and how some of these are relevant to cancer, and all of this process. And after about 4 hours, I said, okay, so you're telling me that the last 25 years of scientific research has produced about 20,000 papers in which there are around about 800 biomarkers that are something to do with cancer, and none of them have gone into practice to help people because individually they're just not good enough. But you think there's small amounts of signal that spread out across those markers that you can use machine learning to aggregate into a strong signal that actually is useful and tells you something about whether or not a patient has cancer. And they were like, yeah, that's what we said. And I said, no, that is not what you said. But if it's what you think you said, then I have understood your idea. I love it. I think it's great. And yes, let's make this happen, right? Like
So
this is
hold
a
on.
brilliant plan.
Let's back it off a second, just because we are a broad church. So, group of scientists, all experts in their own field, had determined that there were 800 different indicators. So, a biomarker is effectively a biological indicator of something. So, it could be the level of something in your blood, it could be the result on a CT scan, it could be other inputs that
It could be
relate
your
to your
height and
body,
weight.
it could be your height, exactly, it could be your height and weight, could be your ethnicity, could be different things. But their theory, their hypothesis was that over 800 of these things, if you were to aggregate them together and find some way to look at these 800 things on a per person basis, you could build a diagnostic engine to predict that person's cancer risk.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, whether or not they have cancer right now, rather than what is their risk in the future,
Oh, it
which is
was
in the.
literally about whether they had
Yeah.
it.
Yeah,
Oh,
exactly.
wow.
Because future risk, right? There's loads of people doing future risk. And whilst I'm sure there's some benefit to it, the problem with it is, what do you do? Like, in the next 10 years, I've got to double the chance of having cancer. Well, you do the same thing as we say to everyone about everything, which is eat better, be
Stop
more
smoking,
sensible,
lose
sleep
weight.
better, stop. Like, great. But if you either do or don't do those
Well,
things.
this is one of the issues around genomics, right? Genomic screening for this cancer risk, which obviously I'm look, I'm a, I, I'm not saying I love genomics. We all love
Yeah, me
genomics. It's all
too.
great, right? Love it. But there is an element of the so what around, oh, you've got double the chance of getting this cancer, so you should live healthier. You're like, oh, okay, cool. I mean, there are some instances, maybe there might be some like proactive surgery you could do, I guess, but there's not really an NHS pathway for that yet. Good Lord, no. I mean, so anyway, carry on, sorry.
So it's it, the point about it is it's
cancer now. So it's these 800 things. And how confident were they? And like, how much evidence did they have around these 800 things being able to? At that
well,
point?
It's a good. So they'd done a systematic review of everything that was like in the academic space, and they wrote a paper called Utley et al, which was published in 2011. And that had brought those together. There's more biomarkers since then. You know, people keep looking for biomarkers. It's a lot easier to get funding to look for a biomarker than it is to actually implement something and change lives, which is the other problem, which is a whole, we can get onto the pipeline issue.
Because I completely agree with you on that.
Right. You can always get money for fundamental research, and implementation, as we know, is the bugbear of the system, right? So they were confident that that was the case. And so I spent the next 9 months working with them to turn this into something that made sense as a, you know, okay, well, how are we actually going to do this? So there were two other insights. So first is pattern detection in multiple biomarkers. Second was, let's solve a clear problem that the NHS has, right? Mm-hmm. So that problem is called the two-week wait. The two-week wait is the thing that happens when they're worried you've got an urgently suspected cancer. And they say, right, you need to be investigated ASAP. Tony Blair said no one should wait more than 2 weeks. They've changed that to a 28-day faster diagnosis standard, but ultimately it's the same thing because it used to be first appointment 2 weeks. Now it's 28 days for an answer, yes or no. So, you know, it's broadly the same kind of timescales. And that problem, when we started doing it, it's a great idea. About 10% of the people on that pathway had cancer, and we saw 1 million people. It's now up to 3 million people going through it a year, and only 6% of them have cancer. So you're catching more cancers.
Are we confident in that statistic?
Yes.
So that statistic is correct. There's no we're not really sure, but we think it's 6%. It is 6%.
Well, okay. So there are 14 pathways. There's 9 that we cover. And in those 9 pathways, the variation is between about 3% prevalence and up to 25%. So if you're on the lung cancer pathway, you've got a very high chance of having cancer because you've often turned up with like coughing up blood or something. And even then, it's still only 20-25%. It's about 20% if you're on the prostate cancer pathway, but most of the others are less than 5%.
Is it, I could talk about this for ages, and Johan's going to start yelling at me about going to a commercial break in a minute, but, when they say in those pathways you do not have cancer, so the 94%, is it that they can't detect cancer, so you might still have it? Or are they saying you definitely don't have it? It's not detectable at this point.
Everything is statistical, right? Like, this is just there are no certainties in medicine, and there's certainly no certainties with this. So they do their best. Every test they do has got area under the curve for its effectiveness, and you know, each successive test. So, you know, like a blood test is not that good. We've made a much better one, but actually at the moment blood tests are kind of rubbish. And then once you've gone on from that, you get a CT scan. CT scans are much better, but they're not 100%. You know, human error, and the human error is crazy. My stepmom works in this with the breast screening service and has done a big load of work with Google. And, you know, humans make mistakes a surprisingly large number of times. And that's with visual stuff, which we're really good at, right? Like, humans have got lots of visual processing cortex. So you move that to numbers, we're terrible at numbers, right? Like, you know, humans are not good at looking at 30 numbers and going, yep, okay, I see the pattern, right? Whereas you look at a picture, you can see a lump and go, oh, actually that looks a bit dodgy. So, you know, no test is perfect. And when you go through that pathway, if they say you haven't got cancer, you've still got a, you know, less than a percent probably chance of having cancer.
Okay.
But it's not zero, you know?
Okay. So we're going to have to go for our first commercial break now. But then after that, I want to pick this thread up exactly where we leave it, which is, and then how does Pinpoint and how did you start to get into this? So we will be back in 2 minutes after this break with my guest today, the amazing Giles Tully, the CEO and co-founder of Pinpoint Data Science, who are the developers of the Pinpoint test, which is, I think, probably the UK's only AI-driven cancer diagnostic test in the way that they do it. And we'll be right back after 2 minutes. This is absolutely fascinating.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
This week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Brewster, my guest today, Giles Tully, the CEO and co-founder of the Pinpoint Test, the AI-driven diagnostic cancer test. So, Giles, before that, the break, we were talking about this two-week wait, 28-day wait for high-risk cancers, of which there's 14 pathways, and you were about to sort of transition across into where Pinpoint sort of evolved and what it was solving. So let's pick that back up.
Yeah. So we looked at this problem. It's 3 million people a year. 94% of them don't have cancer. If you can take people out of that pathway who've got very low risk of cancer, let's say background risk, right? Like, you know, you're walking down the street and you're over 50, you've got a risk of cancer between 0.5% and 1%, because that's just how it is.
That's just sad.
You know, if you are like, so that process, if you can make it more streamlined so that there's fewer people going through that don't have cancer, then the people that do can get seen sooner. And then if you can accelerate the ones who are most likely to have cancer to the front of the queue, you can make the whole thing work better for everybody, right? So that was the second idea, was let's build a decision support tool that looks for patterns and puts patients where they need to be. And there is actually quite an interesting thing here, which I'll come back to, about why that's totally revolutionary. And we spent a long time trying to be a little bit kind of gentle about that, because maybe you don't want to scare the horses, but I've recently decided that is foolish. If something is changing the way things work in a big way, maybe just be honest about it and deal with those concerns. So I'll come back to that. But then the third insight that we had, which is radical, is there's those 800 biomarkers. Loads of them cost a fortune. I mean, you know, you want to do circulating tumor DNA, you got to have special machines. Often you have to send stuff to America.
Okay. You know, that's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. It's complicated. It's difficult. How do you get those things into labs? You know, there's really cool machines that do stuff with magnets and lasers and measure things in really interesting new ways. But the problem is,
it's not,
when's
really
that
going to
be in your local lab? Right? Like,
not scalable.
10 years, 20 years. It's so hard to find space, capital expenditure, all that, you know. So what we said was, what is currently available on the big robotics that we use to do blood testing? Have you ever seen a blood testing system, right?
I got shown around the incredibly whizzy brand new factory of TDL, which is just like King's Cross.
Yeah.
With this like whizzy central thing that whizzes it all up. It's like the Willy Wonka of laboratories. Yeah.
They're incredible, right? It's like a production line for gnomes with tiny tubes with, like, you know, barcodes on them, and they get red every time they go past the machine. Yeah. And the machine goes, oh, I need 0.1 of a milliliter of blood from this thing. And it pulls it out, stabs it through the top, takes a bit of blood, moves it to the next machine, right? These things are incredible bits of industrial capitalism. And whatever you feel about capitalism, which is complicated in the modern world, this is the thing it does well. Like 10,000 tests an hour, right, through this big robot. That's the thing that allows you to get scale and help people efficiently. So we said, what's available on there that we can measure that can be the basis of a pattern detection algorithm? And we whittled that list down. We looked really hard at where's the literature, what interacts with what, you know, like, for example, ferritin, right? A thing that we measure. You can infer ferritin from several other measurements that are cheaper. So why not, you know, the signal that's in it is in other places. So don't use that, just use full blood counts, which have already got loads of signal.
Yeah.
So we use full blood counts, urea and electrolytes, liver and function tests, 7 tumor markers and C-reactive protein. Super standard stuff, you know, things like CA125 you'd have measured for ovarian cancer, but it's actually got signal for loads of other cancers. It's got signal for cancer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, pancreatic cancer has signal in men with CA125, you know, and PSA gives you signal in women, and you think of it as a sort of, you know, prostate.
Is that right?
But yeah.
PSA gives you signal across into female cancer.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
Wow.
Like not all the time, but just, no, you know, sometimes in certain situations, something can cause, it's all about looking for little imbalances that you wouldn't see as a doctor. Cause it's just,
well, you need the machine. You need the machine to look at all of these different, these different things.
And you need a big stack of data as your starting point, and then you need to refine that in the real world. So that's what we set about doing. We started out with some of the people in the team in that original room were from Leeds. Leeds has got really good integrated healthcare data. A guy basically 20 years ago called Jeff Hall said, I think computers are going to be a thing. And all these old surgeons said, oh, no, come on. Like the internet's a fad. And he quietly built a database, which was there when 2010 came around and the 2-week wait happened. And so he collected all the data necessary for the next 10, well, it's still going now. And so we were able to use 372,000 historic patient data from the Leeds ecosystem. So it's across, you know, ethnicities, genders. It's
how does it work? Like how in an ideal world would this work, right? To try and help? Because what it sounds like what you're trying to do is to say, right, there's 94% of people that shouldn't really be waiting 28 weeks, because if they did this thing, they could be basically, not all 94%, but some percentage of the 94% could be immediately ruled out and they wouldn't have to worry.
Yeah.
That kind of that's the.
Yeah. So I'm going to get into the sort of the thing that's like special, which I mentioned earlier, right? So on our website, I was looking at this video, we made this video and I thought, God, this is actually quite a big deal. I'm going to talk about it more. So we have lovely Kat, who's one of our senior data scientists, doing a little bit of chat about what happens with machine learning versus traditional processes, right? So when you do a traditional diagnostic process, you take rules from biology, right? Yeah. And you apply them to data you get from machines to get answers, right? So you use your rules from biology, you've got your data from your CT scanner, your blood test, your whatever, and then you get yourself an answer, cancer, not cancer, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you use machine learning, you flip that process around. So you take data and answers, right? So you've got the data from your machines, you've got your data from your blood tests, you've got what you found out at the end, this person had cancer or not, and what kind of cancer it was. And then you use that to generate new rules, which you can use to make the system work better. And then because it's machine learning, that is a recursive loop, right? So that is a totally dramatic change to the way healthcare systems work. And I would argue it's how all systems should be designed into the future. It's already the case in lots of systems, but healthcare, unsurprisingly, is slower. And indeed, that process has to be done supervised. So lots of your internet systems are self-learning, right? And then someone checks afterwards if anything's gone wrong with it. The way we do it is we have built a regulated medical device. We've integrated the regulation into the way that we iteratively improve it. Right. So we make better versions of the test. And when we make a better version, it's immediately easily regulated.
How do you know it's better? Like, are you comparing it to some ground truth on a consistent basis?
Yes. Yeah. So you've got what you have to have is you have to have reliable data inputs. You've got to know what the blood tests were and feel confident that those are reliable. So you're using NHS blood testing. And then you have to make sure that the testing that's being done in the NHS is high quality, which it is. And of course, right, there's going to be some missed cancers, but you follow up on that. So you include a 12-month follow-up. So you know, okay, this person was missed. They were found 6 months later. And it's one of the things we've seen we can really help with is lots of people go in on the wrong pathway. You go in for lower GI, it turns out you're actually upper GI. You go in for lower GI, it turns out it's gynecological. you go in for gynecological, it turns out anything's internal, it's, you know, you've got some vague symptoms, where is it? And right. we can help indicate, okay, actually you should be here or there. We're building a version of the project that's product that specifically
how does that like literally like step by step, like how how does that all fit together? Like, let's take that example where like you think somebody goes in on one of the 14 pathways and they've got, oh, I've got stomach pain, I've had it for 6 months. And actually it turns out not to be upper GI, it's lower GI. But like, how would this pinpoint, your pinpoint technology, how would it help that?
So first off, there's 14 pathways, but five of them are the super rare ones. So that's less than a percent. It's like things like brain cancer and testicular cancer. They're all bunched up in that sort of last 1.5%. There's five pathways. And then the remaining nine are the kind of standard ones we've all heard of. So you've got upper GI, lower GI, head and neck, skin, urological, gynecological, hematological, lung, and breast, right? Those, and I do those in a different order every time. and so we've got data now. We took that historic work. We developed algorithms for all nine pathways. Then we hit the pandemic, and the NHS said, "Have you got anything to help us come out of this?" We said, "Yes." We entered into a big service evaluation with the NHS in Yorkshire. Then we got a load of funding from SBRI to support that. And we've just completed, it'll be in a 2-3 days time, we close it, and all the data will then be coming through for the rest of the year. And we'll have sort of final results of everything at the end of this year. And that's taken about 17,000 tests of everybody going through and being tested to see, did it do what we said it would do? Can we build a better version in the future? And so are our claims about A, it works, and B, it will get better, correct? And will it then therefore be better than what we currently do?
More affordable.
Yes, and indeed more affordable. Exactly. Will it save money? Will it work better? And so what we've moved on to now, we just had a really big workshop about this recently with loads of senior leaders, clinicians, people from CRUK, that's Cancer Research UK, Yorkshire Cancer Research, loads of the smaller charities turned up, GPs, patients. It was really cool. And there was a general consensus around specifically our lower GI test. So our lower GI test went through first because it's got one of the largest throughputs. Out of those 3 million, about 600,000 of them go through it for lower GI. And so that test went through first, had really good data, and we got support from Innovate UK to deploy it in West Yorkshire. And then we've just been in that slow process of working with the NHS to get it in, because as you know, these things are never as quick as you would like them to be. And so what it'll be is you go to see, now that we've shown that it does what it's supposed to do and that it performs, if you combine it with the fit test, it performs drastically better than either the fit test or the pinpoint test.
What's the fit test? Is that the fecal occult blood sample?
No. It's the fecal immunochemical test, which is the upgraded version of the fecal occult blood sample that they used to
do. But it's still a fecal sample at home.
Yes, exactly. Okay. And because it's fecal, it's complementary. You know, a blood test tests different things. And so when you combine the two, you get a much better performance than either one on their own. But also, if you just use the pinpoint test, you get almost the same performance as you do with the fit test. So, you know, there are cultural sensitivities around the fit test. There are people who can't do it. You know, messing around with poo is difficult for various reasons. And so actually it gives you a tool that says, well, what am I going to do with this patient who doesn't have a fit test? Okay, well, I've got a screaming high pinpoint score, they should be seen, or I've got a really low pinpoint score, brilliant.
How will it work in actual day-to-day for a patient? What would happen?
So you go to your GP, and to you it would look very similar, right? Like your GP is ordering a blood test. They've just happened to have a blood test that is upgraded with AI. So currently blood tests aren't very good. And so what they do with that blood test is they go, oh, are you anemic? Okay, you are. All right, that could be anything, but it puts you up the risk score. So let's send you for a colonoscopy.
Okay.
What would happen instead is you have a pinpoint test and a fit test at the same time. And then those results can be used by the GP to say, okay, I am still quite worried about you. Let's accelerate you. We can get, so at the moment, if you take 10%, the top 10%, you'll get 10% of the cancers. If you use the pinpoint test, you'd get 43% of the cancers in that top 10%. So all those people will get into treatment sooner and they'll go through the pathway quicker.
Why? Because you're the combination of the pinpoint with the existing makes it more accurate. Yeah. You'll find more of them.
Yeah, yeah. You'll find and you'll prioritize the ones who are most likely to have cancer into that top set for investigation.
Okay.
And of course, the dream would be just do people in order because you'll catch all the cancers quicker. The difficulty is, so if you do the top 50%, you get over 80% of the cancers, for example.
Okay.
Right. So you only need to see half as many people and you're still getting most of the cancers in there. That is a big change because at the moment what happens is you turn up in date order and you just get seen.
Yeah, it's completely chronological.
Yeah, yeah. And then at the other end, you can rule people out with more certainty. So at the moment, they use the FIT test to rule people out. You can either use the pinpoint test to rule people out with more certainty, fewer false negatives, you know, it's half as many false negatives, for example. Or you can say, let's use the same performance of the FIT test and rule more people out with the same level of certainty that the system is already happy with.
Okay.
So, you know, it gives you a tool to basically manage demand. So many NHS trusts have got massive queues, and that itself is, of course, bad for people. So having this kind of intelligent tool at the front end of your pathway that joins up with the results, that's what is changing things.
So,
the patient doesn't really see much, right? They just see, my doctor did the blood test. It made my life better.
So in this is all, as many things in the NHS, is eminently sensible. And it also aligns massively with the 10-year plan that just came out, which is, you know, treatment to prevention, bringing waiting lists down, using technology to improve patient lives, improve speed to treatment, you know, analog to digital, all it ticks so many different boxes. I suspect it isn't as easy as it sounds in terms of uptake and adoption. So without wishing to like get all of the laundry out necessarily, and bearing in mind we're a broad church, what if you wanted people listening to try and understand why things that sound so simple and common sense don't get taken up as quickly as they might expect, how would you explain that to people listening?
So, I mean, I think we touched on it earlier. I think one of the biggest issues, and this is not unique to the UK, right? Mm-hmm. Like I've talked to my sister about this. She's in health tech, mental health in the US. You know, she's worked with big state systems. She's in California. I've talked to other people around the world. The money for implementing just doesn't really exist. Whereas we will have all seen news stories. I get sent them by my investors all the time being like, oh my God, there's this new cancer test. It's going to change everything. What are you going to do about it? And it's like, look, like it's 10 years from being implemented. Like they've just done a cool experiment, but the cool experiment sounds really sexy and you can get some press about it. And that gets you some investment for that company. But you know, we're dealing with the difficult nitty gritty of going to local medical councils, talking to GPs, understanding that they are stressed and overworked. And what happens is you want to bring in a new thing. They're told, do it. And they go, well, I'm not being paid for it. Like, so you want me to do an extra thing? I have to explain something to a patient, but there's no money for that. I don't want to do it. So then you have to find some money to cover that. Right. Then you have to deal with, oh, how is this going to change our processes? There are, and there are lots of great people in the NHS who would never say a thing like this, but we have heard people say, we do colonoscopies here. We make money out of those colonoscopies. We don't want to do fewer colonoscopies. Right?
Private hospitals, right?
NHS hospitals.
How do they make money out of that?
Well, because your budget is based upon how many things you do in a year.
It's work item based, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there's the whole internal market that Thatcher created. So, another example of like how the kinds of barriers that exist is because there's an internal market, if you want to do a blood test in a trust, they all don't tell each other how much they're paying for these things.
Yeah.
Because they're forced. This is not like evil. They're forced into an incentive structure which says I could bolster my budget by doing a send away test for 80 quid that I know costs me £5. Right. So that happens and that causes, you know, and then you have to have a meeting where you bring in someone from the NHS to talk to another lab and they go, well, we're doing it for 35. How about you stop charging 90? Right. And so there's loads of little barriers like that. And I think that one of the things that happens is just the number of conversations that you have to have with different bits of the system who have not been aligned it slows everything down. And if I'm to be optimistic, I think that there are lots of good things in the reforms that they're bringing in around joining it. So you look at Jim Mackey's trust is a bit of a, like, where he came from is apparently a bit of an exemplar for this. So they joined up primary and secondary care and social care, and things work better because, you know, you can discharge someone into the community rather than having to keep them in an expensive hospital bed, but they go into social care, they're looked after appropriately, they don't suddenly bounce back in. GPs are able to refer into a joined up secondary care that listens to them. That kind of giving the trust the ability to join up with primary care more effectively should be what comes from the next few years of reforms. It's just, you know, to be on the downside, those things are slower than we would like, right? Particularly as small companies.
Well, let's pick this up in the last part of the show. So we're going to go for our final commercial break now. And we'll be back in 2 minutes for the last part of today's show with my guest today, Giles Tully, who is the CEO of Pinpoint Data Science. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, ant and deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the final part of today's show with my guest today, Giles Tully, whose company, Pinpoint Data Science, have developed a unique, world-changing, AI-driven cancer diagnostic test that is being scaled out to the NHS. So let's just pick back up on that thread. So I think that there's something really interesting for the broader listeners here around the NHS and the way it works and how it picks up innovation. And it's what I've said before is that the NHS is actually really, really good, or the government is really good about funding phase ones, pilots, really good, tons of cash, Innovate UK, SBRI, NIHR, loads of acronyms, really good at it. The real challenge is around how to translate that into a phase two or a phase three, which has wider uptake. And the thing that I don't understand, but I'd love your thoughts on, I still haven't got my head around this, is that the NHS actually procures huge volumes of medical technology and innovation and things like that through standardized procurement. So, like, you know, spends £127 billion a year. A lot of that is workforce, but a lot of it isn't. And so there's something weird that isn't matching up for me here around somehow innovation is stuck in sometimes this phase one land, but at the same time, the system is acquiring huge volumes of lab testing, lab capacity, medical supplies, innovation, medical technology. I just don't quite know how we bridge those things.
Well, I mean, look, you're going to get me with my political hat on if you're not careful. So, you know,
you do whatever you want to do, John.
So look, I think that there is a serious problem in the UK, which is that we are ideologically wedded to the concept of the free market, right? Okay. So as a consequence, we are the only country in the advanced world, in the top 20, in the G20, maybe even longer than that, that does not have a buy British policy, right? And obviously they have their own buy China, buy France, buy Italy, buy whatever it may be, right? Like if you go to Italy, no one has a Bosch boiler. even though the Pirelli boiler is objectively worse. I apologize, Italians, but this is a fact. However, you can't get anyone to fix it, so it's useless to you, right? Like the UK, for reasons that are historical, we just think that, you know, free trade is great. And of course, free trade has lots of benefits. The downside is if everyone else is playing mercantilism, so, you know, they're benefiting their own economy like China is doing, like lots of countries, like America is doing with its tariffs. Then if you play the, let's all just play a nice friendly game of free trade, everyone just predates your stuff. So 50% of the UK is owned by the US, right? Like that's just
what do you mean by that?
So if you, about 30% of the companies in the UK are owned by US companies, obviously. And then another 20% are owned via shell companies in Ireland, Luxembourg, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? And so when you go to the NHS and the NHS, and because of this sort of belief, right, the NHS goes, oh, we should buy the big American thing, which was designed for the American context that, you know, let's take electronic healthcare records, right? Like, I'm not going to talk about specific brands, but we know there's a big American one. And those guys are great for the American context, but everyone does not love them as much for the UK context. And that is true of, let's say, Palantir. It's true of, you know, a lot of things that we, and it's because we have both have this belief in the international, and I don't think we have confidence in ourselves as innovators.
It is weird, though. It is weird. Do you know what? I'm not going to get into the political, because I'm not quite as politically, I'm not sure I'm quite as political as you, but there is definitely something here where, because everyone talks about the quote lack of ambition in the UK, right? That's a that's a thing, you know. That's what I've heard it be a thing. And then I you know, I actually know loads of entrepreneurs that work their absolute nuts off and are ambitious. So that doesn't track for me as like one generic statement. And so I what I wonder is, maybe you're right in that actually those other countries are more inclined to purchase effectively, to be really good customers for local businesses, and actually it's not necessarily ambition, but it just looks like ambition after the fact. And really all it is traction and revenue growth.
Like if you know, I've got a French car, everything in that car is French, down to the speakers. They went to a local small French sound manufacturer and was like, let's buy your speakers, not German ones. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm saying that makes a big difference in particularly the NHS. The NHS is this incredible situation, right? If you joined up the dots, like we're talking about doing, with all of the cool companies that are in the NAA, right, the NHS Innovation Accelerator, you could have a healthcare system that was data-driven, that got better, like year on year, month on month, in response to problems, and it would build trillion-dollar companies out of the UK, which could export that stuff around the world. But you have to have some vision that says we're prepared to do that, and we're prepared to support that kind of like national growth, rather than saying, ah, it's all right, we'll let the Americans do it, they can buy those companies.
And so this is where this is another thing that's occurred to me, which is what I've seen the government do, and I'm sure people listening have seen this as well, when they say, oh, we want the UK to be you know, the leader in AI, and so we've created a huge fund to you know, a multi-billion-dollar research fund to fund AI, so that Britain can be the leader in AI. And actually, what that means is that it's going to be a bunch of grants given to really early stage things, for the most part, research, and there is no funding really to help you scale beyond that. And it's the same way in health. And you could argue, well, like, actually, government funding, state funding isn't very good at actually picking winners. So they are better off playing at that early stage. But where is the support for the scale up? Right. Because actually, you know, you're in a lot of these tender situations. I mean, we're not, because it's a little bit different the way that our area of the world in PocTalks. And actually, a lot of the things, like, for example, your thing won't appear on procurement frameworks because it's new.
No, we are on a procurement framework, actually. Yeah, we're on GCloud.
Like, oh, great. But what I mean is stuff isn't going to tender.
Because there's a new thing. Yeah, what's the alternative? There isn't one, you know.
What do you put out on the, we are looking for an AI, we have an open tender for AI-driven cancer diagnostics. It doesn't really work. And I think that's where the system's really good at procuring stuff that it's already procured.
Yeah.
I'm not sure there needs to be a lot more thinking about how to procure at scale new things.
Yeah.
And I think, from what I can tell, that's a really difficult, multifaceted, unsexy problem that people aren't interested really in digging into on the system side. They're much more interested in sexy stuff that can be branded well, yeah, like innovation passports, yeah, and things that get headlines, as opposed to really boring, unsexy stuff about, like, how could we make procurement work better for SMEs?
Well, and I think, yes, definitely. And there is the issue that says, if you're going to do this, there must be hypothecated budgets. What do I mean by that? I mean budgets that are specifically for this thing, rather than, you know, there's money in a big pot and you can just do what you like with it, and then it gets put on the old stuff. And that's the
tricky thing for something like yours, which is,
yeah,
you've got a multifaceted arrangement where the benefit of your thing isn't in the area that might actually, yeah, spend the time and incur the cost to do the thing.
Yeah.
And so then it becomes a hydra, what is it? Like some kind of hydra, yeah, type thing about how, yeah, to work out the budget flows. It's really, yeah, tricky.
Well, and it's why we sit naturally at the ICB level. So joining, yeah, up primary and secondary care and social care and all the rest of it. But, you know, as we know, they've had a big effect on the number of staff they've got to have. That's taken up a lot of time. That's still where it's going on. I mean, I don't, you know, there are individuals in the NHS doing amazing stuff despite the pressures, making,
yeah,
it possible to try and join up those dots. And that's what we're doing in Yorkshire. And I suspect that we will be in a position where it's deployed at significant scale in Yorkshire over the next year or so. And hopefully going into multiple pathways, because, you know, we had the lower GI stuff, but we've also got amazing results in gynecological, upper gastrointestinal, lung, head and neck. And we're building a combined test that, you know, helps. As to a question we asked earlier, is if you can look at the signal and tune it for multiple different cancers, then you can say, well, there's a chance that it's more likely that you should look for this cancer first than that one, right? Because you can do that in the pattern detection.
Yeah.
So
that's super interesting.
You know,
so we're in the last 3 minutes of the show. I feel like we could talk for hours, but in the last 3 minutes of the show, what I always ask is, obviously, a man like yourself, you've been through all kinds of career iterations, you know, pop star, music producer, goodness knows what else, China, UK, cancer diagnostics. What kind of motto or phrase or mindset do you rely on to get you through the inevitable, crazy, difficult moments that I'm sure you've been through, that you think passing on to the listeners is a net benefit?
Well, I think, as I said at the beginning, as part of my story, is I think getting good at not knowing what you're doing and getting comfortable with that thing where, like, so when you start doing a new thing, it's difficult and stressful and annoying. And, you know, you do it and you're like, I'm not very good at this. And you feel bad and you feel kind of, you know, useless and incompetent. And you get to that sort of end of the day and you're lying in your bed and you're thinking, I don't know what I'm doing. I've got no idea how to fix this. And the thing that I remind myself of is I have done this to loads of different things, loads of different times. And I always go through that period of the sort of long, dark night of the soul. And then you come out the other side and get a decent night's sleep and wake up in the morning and find a way through. So I think it's really about that for me. Is I, like, recently, you know, this last year, I think this has happened to a lot of innovators. I can think of lots of people who've lost their companies. I know people I've known for 10, 15 years who just couldn't raise that 20, 35, 1 million, you know, different levels. And we got very close because, you know, things are slow. And that time was super stressful. But, you know, we came through it. And a lot of my investors said to me, come on, Giles, you've had this 7 or 8 times. That's what it's like, you know. So
Perfect.
Just remember, you'll be able to do it.
On that note, we're about to close the show. So thank you very much for listening. We'll be back again next week.